Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. How does the Electoral College work and how does it affect South Dakota voters? Mike Card is an associate professor of political science at the University of South Dakota. He joins us today to break this down and help us understand it a little better. Dr. Card, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me on this snowy morning in Vermilion.
You know, it is snowing in Sioux Falls, and I acknowledge my position of privilege. I don't have to drive in this today, so I just get to enjoy how pretty it is. And that's not necessarily a bad thing to be grateful for. So slow down, turn on your headlights, take it easy out there. For snow, always lots of accidents. So use caution. All right, Mike. We have a pretty educated listenership here on In the Moment as a general rule, and still the Electoral College can be a little confusing for people, especially as, you know, you hear more and more news about, you know, when those electors, you know, cast their votes and what terminology to use. So thank you so much for joining us to help explain some of the basics and some of the more nuanced complexities of this. Let's start with a little bit of history, because the Founding Fathers, did they create the Electoral College based on what? Like, take us back to how this system was put into place.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to start is, you know, the first place is to recognize that when we vote for president, we actually don't vote for president. We vote for a set of electors that has been nominated by their political party. So in South Dakota, pending the canvass of the votes, the people who will vote for president will be Governor Noem, Lieutenant Governor Roden, and Attorney General Ravensburg, because the electors for Donald Trump have the lead in the vote, and I suspect that will be sustained when the state canvassing board certifies the results later this week. So then we ask, okay, how did we get to this process where we don't actually get to choose who our president is? Well, in 1787, there weren't very many democracies in the world that had any size at all to them. And there certainly weren't any that were the size of the 13 former colonies. And yet at that time, what we had as models were monarchs and emperors. So who's going to, what is our mechanism going to be for choosing the administrative head of state? So in a sense, you know, if you'll forgive me a little bit of humor here, we don't have a lady in the lake who's holding out a sword. We don't have a sword stuck in a rock that the strongest man can pull out. So they had to invent this, so to speak, out of whole cloth. That is, we've got to figure out a mechanism with our democratic republic that we're going to use to select our leaders. And given that most of our founders were men of the Enlightenment, Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 68 noted that our president should be chosen by men most capable of analyzing the qualities adapted to the station of the position. And yet, at the same time, no one who is faithful to our history can deny that the plan originally contemplated is that electors would be free agents, that they would exercise an independent and nonpartisan judgment as to the individuals who are best qualified. Well, that isn't what we have, but that was what they had in mind, at least with respect to Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, as well as what we know from the history of the day, is we want to choose great men to choose a great man to be our president.
All right. So let's talk about the big and the small, and the idea that a state like South Dakota, you know, can send two senators to Washington, just like a state like California sends two senators to Washington, and how those Electoral College numbers are factored in.
Okay. Well, the Electoral College, if we think of it, is really a process of both selecting electors, the meeting of the electors, and then they vote for the president and vice president. And then Congress will eventually count the electoral votes on January 6th of 2021. But it is the case that the electors were chosen partly by what our history tells us was the Great Compromise, in the sense that we would select a Senate based on 2 senators per state and allocate to Congress to determine the number of representatives, but the representatives would be proportionally to the population of the state. So in South Dakota, we have 3 electoral votes because we have 2 senators and 1 representative. And those 3 electoral votes, if we divide them into the state's population into the total U.S. population, have an electoral vote for about every 275,000 people. If we look at New York, they have an electoral vote for about every 675,000 people.
Does that, I want to play a little audio here to enrich our conversation, Mike Gart. And this was a great interview I think you would appreciate. This morning on Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep was talking to journalist Tom Ricks, who is the author of a book called First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. And this first one is going to lead to a question I have for you about, after times have changed, how is the situation in South Dakota changed as far as the Electoral College and our influence? It here is a little bit of Tom Ricks talking about the big states and the small states.
The problem is the difference between big and small back then wasn't as big. The smallest state coming in was Delaware. The biggest was Virginia. Virginia was about 12 times the population of Delaware. Nowadays, the biggest state in population is California. The smallest is Wyoming. And the difference in citizens and in voters is about 50-1.
So, Mike, the population has changed a lot as some of those cities, and you could hear and see the frustration on election night, including a moment where John King of CNN kind of waved his hand vaguely over where South Dakota is and said, "I understand nobody lives here." And I just laughed. And I was like, well, let's be specific, John King, because I'm living here right now. But you see this big swath of red, but yet then these little pockets of blue are out. You know, so the visuals are a little bit difficult to understand. Are South Dakotans heard more than we were, you know, than those small states were in the beginning of the Union? Are we heard less than some of those small states were in the beginning of the Union from an Electoral College perspective?
Well, I would interpret Mr. Ricks's comments to indicate that we have less of an influence than we had relative to the larger states. And that leads some people to conclude that we should never get rid of the Electoral College, because then what will happen as our state may continue to decrease? We're growing at about 8% per year currently, and California is not growing at a great at that rate, but is still growing. Texas and Florida are actually growing at faster rates, and they're projected to get 3 additional electoral votes. But it's also recalling we can't get any fewer than 3 electoral votes. That's what we're going to have as long as the population increases, and we're not increasing in number to get to the point of justifying 2 representatives again, or 3 as we had up until the 1930 census, where we had 5 electoral votes.
Is that how? Okay, I did not know that. I don't think I knew that fact. Maybe I did and I forgot. So people have this sense of frustration then about the Electoral College in general and where the country... Does this lead to more division? And that leads me to the next sort of question about what... how division and compromise works based on how the founders set that up.
Well, we've already gone a ways away from what the founders expected, because now the political parties nominate the electors as opposed to the state legislature from the first part of the country nominating who the electors would be for their state. The state legislature can still decide how they're going to select the electors in a state, but every state currently has chosen to let a popular vote select the electors. And when you're saying, how does that go forward with respect to where we go, I expect that given our rural heritage and rural dominance, because rural is rural in South Dakota, and yet all except for a few areas, agriculture seems to generate a large part of our economy. Although we've diversified our economy, many of the states in the Upper Great Plains state have a similar agricultural dependence, which produces a certain amount of conservatism, and we've got similar interests. And so I would be surprised if too many of the Upper Great Plains states were to start to vote Democratic, or what I would call the moralistic political tradition, in believing that government can help take care of us when we can't take care of ourselves. And I don't know that that's a particular viewpoint that's widely held in South Dakota.
Yeah. You want to play another clip from this?
Or Nebraska or Kansas.
I want to play another clip from this interview because I'm really curious to know if you agree with this. And this is author Tom Rick talking about what many of us are so frustrated with sometimes in 2020, which is the notion of gridlock and what it means.
The entire Constitution is in many ways a peace treaty between different states, a series of compromises. And this goes again to the genius of James Madison. He said, we're going to have a series of balances. We're going to disperse power so broadly among three branches of the federal government and two houses within the legislative branch, between the federal government and the state government. Spread the power out so that if you're going to try to do anything in this country, you're going to have to make deals and compromises. And if you can't, you're going to get gridlock. And the way Madison designs it, gridlock is not a bug. It's a feature. It says we don't trust power because we saw in the ancient world how when one person or one group becomes too powerful, it throws things out of whack. So we're going to force people to try to put power together through series of deals and compromises. So I think Madison especially would be very proud to see that when America deeply disagrees, as it does now, that things grind to a halt.
That's a little bit from Tom Ricks on an interview with Steve Inskeep this morning. A Morning Edition, and Tom Ricks is the author of a book called First Principles, but my guest right now is Mike Card from the University of South Dakota. And we get so frustrated with gridlock and with things not moving forward. Mike Card, do you agree here that the gridlock is, in a sense, not a bug, but a feature of the Electoral College, of the U.S. Constitution, of the principles of the Founding Fathers?
Well, I'm going to both agree. Well, I'm not going to agree with that, Lori, but let me agree first with Mr. Ricks to say that our nation is built upon a series of compromises. And if we cannot compromise because we're playing winner take all and playing for keeps, meaning we will do what it takes to win any particular battle of ideas, then compromise is going to be really hard. But if we keep playing that way, then we will have gridlock that doesn't let us make decisions one way or another. So what we will then be forced to do, or have the opportunity to do, is eventually come to some form of compromise. And in a sense, if I were in the business community, in a sense, I might like divided government. That is that as we have now, the House of Representatives is controlled by the Democratic Party and the Senate is likely to be controlled by the Republican Party. And the president will be one of those two parties, but we've got some steps to go to get there through canvassing of votes and resolving disputes that may arise. But then we don't get things done that there isn't consensus behind. And if we don't try to find consensus, then we're not going to compromise and we're not going to get much done. So things will stay the same.
Right.
Which may be what some desire.
Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, we have a global pandemic. We have massive issues to deal with, and immigration and climate and, other things that affect people's lives and affect the future. So back to the core of what we're kind of talking about. You mentioned January 6th is when the Electoral College gathers are electors for South
Well,
Dakota, Governor Noem, Lieutenant Governor Roden, Attorney General Jason Raunsberg. And if Jason Raunsberg is not available to come and he's not been charged with anything yet in this fatal car accident, he's just replaced by the leader of the state Republican Party, is what I'm told. And that's not unprecedented that an elector wasn't able to, to be there to cast the votes for, in this case, Donald Trump. Do I understand
Right.
all
There's a
that? How?
procedure.
Yeah,
There's
tell
a
me a little bit about
procedure in
that.
state law that provides to that, and that's South Dakota Codified Law 1224. Think of the night before Christmas. But let me step back a second and say, on December 8th, the states have to forward to Congress and to the National Archives the list of electors from the state. If a state doesn't send that in, then it's a disputed election, and that state's electoral votes will fall to Congress when it meets on January 3rd, and they meet on January 6th to count the electoral votes that would have been cast on December 14th. So I skipped a step there. If we think Election Day, such as it is anymore, was November 3rd, the electors have to be sent to Congress. The names of the electors have to be sent to Congress on December 8th. On December 14th, the electors gather in the state capitals. Ours will obviously be in Pierre, and notify their attendance in Pierre, and then meet at the state capitol, cast their votes, and send the popular vote for all electors to Congress and to the National Archives, along with their votes. Congress, in joint session, certifies the Electoral College vote. That's why I call it a process. It's a series of steps. And then on January 20th, the person who's certified as winning the election will be inaugurated as president, and the person as vice president will be inaugurated.
In South Dakota, those steps are highly predictable because of how strongly the popular vote in this state went to President Donald Trump. In other states that we've been following, where things are much closer, is there a potential for disputes for electors who are, in quotation marks, rogue and kind of decide to go in a different direction? Like, what are some of the areas this can get a little more messy in states where things were contested hotly?
Well, if there is a contested election and the state election official doesn't certify their results by December 8th, it is a contested state slate of electors, and Congress has the ability to deal with that dispute. But more than likely, one set of electors will be sent forward, and then Congress can choose, if there is an objection to the state slate of electors that's sent in. We're getting deep in the weeds here, but one senator and one member of the House of Representatives must file an objection. Then the Congress will recess the joint session, and each branch will address the controversy or the contested election and determine which slate to seat. If we go back to 1876, the first time that we had a president who seemed to be winning the popular vote not get the most electoral votes, Congress effectively decided, based on that sort of system, with lots of negotiation between the House and the Senate, as to who would be president.
Interesting. Any final thoughts about the Electoral College, Mike Card? It's complicated. It's fascinating. If you're biting your nails hoping for one candidate or the other, it maybe is a little stressful. But it is all part of this sort of uniquely American process.
Well, it is. And I suspect if we were to start over from scratch, we would make different compromises than the ones that we did with respect to the Senate and the House. There are steps afoot the interstate compact that has been proposed and a number of states have approved would cast their ballots for whoever wins the national popular vote. And I think there's about 30 states or so have joined that compact. So the other mechanism to have a popular elector, the candidate who wins the most popular votes be selected, would require a constitutional amendment. And I'm not seeing a route to that at this point.
Yeah. All right. And a little something in the beginning. Go ahead.
With some of our disputes, they will be resolved before December 8th. You know, the two that I've heard of are, there are some ballots with single markings on them, and it's quite common in a hotly contested election that the people who vote will vote on only one issue and or one candidate. There may be malfeasance occurring there, but it's not a definite. So those situations will have to be investigated. And again, we had a hotly contested presidential election, so I would expect there would be a number of ballots with only one mark on them. The other things that we worry about are how many people shouldn't have voted who did, when do these ballots come in? Military ballots will come in late, especially in a state like Georgia, which has two forts and an Air Force base, if my memory serves me right. And I believe their ballots can come in through Friday.
Interesting.
So we may not know for a while.
And we can't assume who those ballots are for either, as we've learned from, you know, you can make an assumption about who those ballots are for, but not this year. You can't. And so we'll talk about this much more in the future. Mike Card, thanks for getting us started. Some basics for the people who are trying to figure out the basics, and then some really good in the weed stuff for those who are thinking deeply about how this process plays out. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you for having me.